Welcome to the eLaborate Topics podcast, where we focus on lab-specific strategies for medical laboratory professionals. We're proud to be the healthcare detectives that work behind the scenes to get the results needed to influence medical decisions. Let's grow together and jump right into the lab.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to another episode of eLaborate Topics. I'm your host for today's show, Stephanie Whitehead, and I'm so excited for our show today. For those of you tuning in for the first time, I'm your podcasting executive leader and co-host for this show. eLaborate Topics is a weekly podcast where myself and my co-host, Tywana Wilson and Lona Smalls, are bringing you topics related to laboratory and leadership to help you excel inside and outside the laboratory. And today I have Christine Talamante. Thank you for joining me, Christine.
Hello, Stephanie. Thanks for having me.
Christine is a special guest of the show, and I'm super excited for her to share her expertise and her gift of really talking about a really relevant topic to all healthcare leaders, especially today. The topic for today's show is When Compassion Hurts, and we're going to be discussing today how to support the second victim. Christine herself is a strong advocate in self-care, team morale, and ensuring that the staff feel safe. She has been asked to speak with new nurses, teams about compassion fatigue, burnout, moral distress, and special in the second victim. And so I really want to get into this conversation because I know particularly with all health co-workers, but also the laboratory professionals working behind the scenes, the stress and the burnout from the increase of testing, from seeing the impact of COVID-19 on our friends, our co-workers, our clinical staff, and our families can be especially distressing to our teams. So, Christine, you have a lot of different strength and experience, so I want you to go in and just really tell the listeners about your journey and how you got to the place you are today.
Sure, Stephanie. Again, thank you for helping to bring this very important topic to light. It's something that's really dear to my heart, but especially right now during this pandemic, I think it's something that everybody in leadership really needs to get a grasp on. And so I'll give you a little history on myself. I'm a registered nurse. I have a master's degree from Grand Canyon University in nursing leadership, and I've worked every type of nursing for a very large hospital for a while. So part of my journey has been starting out as a young nurse working in areas where they had, TB patients and HIV patients where nobody really wanted those assignments. And I found myself kind of drawn to them. I kind of find myself like, well, that's why I became a nurse, right? So I was more like the compassionate young nurse. And everybody's like, oh, you're so cute. You're so sweet. But like, as you get older, you'll realize that, you can't save every life. And I was like, well, I don't want to save them, but I want to be compassionate toward them. So I worked in different areas. Again, I worked with families. I had the fortunate opportunity to work with children in child abuse situations. And I say fortunate because we were able to save a lot of families and their children. Though it was a very difficult job, again, I found myself, instead of being opposed to this taboo subject, I kind of wanted to know more about these stories. You know, what's going on with these families that these children are getting injured? And so I would do some research on, temperaments of the family. You know, what caused this? What happened before? You know, did dad lose his job? Were they in poverty? Why were these things happening? And realizing that they themselves were victims of poverty or of this community. And then when I moved on from there, I was working with newborn NICU. Again, I found myself working with moms who had stillborns or moms who had, twins, but they didn't make it, or maybe they stayed in the NICU for a long time. And again, I found myself saying, what could I do to help these people? Because they're here for this bouncing baby boy, and then they leave with nothing. And so I felt like that was an opportunity for me to kind of talk to them and find out what it was that could help them. Again, what I saw in every stage of this was the staff. And the staff was either all in, like I was, like, we got to do something for this mom, we've got to do something for this kid, or, like, I'm just going to ignore it and pretend like it didn't happen. But what we would see was this, it used to be called burnout, but now it's almost like a compassion fatigue, right? You see it so many times, and you either, like, you just get numb to it. And so that's not healthy either. And so I kind of started recognizing that and seeing that in my friends, like, oh, wow, you know, so-and-so used to be really into this, and now she's, like, calling in, or, you know, now she's not really, you know, doing as much as she used to. So I noticed that. Then I went to work, and I think this is when I met you, was when I started working in risk management and quality. And that was my first non-bedside job. And so I was kind of like, well, I don't know if I'm good at this, but I want to give it a shot. And what I learned is that my patient or my client became the staff. So we would do things like investigate medication errors or investigate, errors that happened in the lab. Or something that happened in the OR, maybe a medication error, a nurse gave the wrong med, and the patient had some bleeding, or maybe a patient passed away, or maybe there was an error. And what I found was that we would call these, you know, we would do like a root cause analysis, and we would call everybody in, and we'd talk about all this stuff, and who's not really blaming, but kind of like who did this, who didn't do this, well, what happened, how did this happen, well, I forgot to do this, well, I was running late that day, and that was all very helpful, but what I realized was that after we went through this very painful kind of evaluation of the error, then we just let everybody go, like, okay, well, thanks for coming to this meeting, and we let everybody leave, and I kind of felt like, how can you do that, you know, you're bringing up this thing that is making everybody feel like, was it my fault? Was it her fault? Nonetheless, a patient was injured or something happened that we had to have this discussion, and we didn't provide any follow-up with these people. And so I felt very bad, and that's when I kind of started looking at things like second victim. And that's kind of where all this interest started, and I started getting asked to speak about the subject.
Wow. Really good. So in your role, you do a lot of work with frontline healthcare workers. So I just think that your work is so profound and that everything you're doing is extremely positive in taking what are normal situations in healthcare and turning those into ways that you can support frontline workers and making sure that, you know, they are mentally and emotionally able to continue to do the work that we do every day. And I remember some of those root cause analyses that I sat in with you when you worked in risk management. And you're right, because even though during some of the meetings we would discuss functions that didn't have to do with anything pertaining to my department, which is laboratory, I still got to hear the totality of events that occurred with that patient or that situation. And then you leave a meeting, you know, and that sticks with you, and you think and you contemplate and you wonder. And so the resources to help us with that emotionally and mentally in the aftermath are so important. Can you give us a little bit more information for layman terms and people like me who may have never heard of this before on who or what is the second victim?
Absolutely, Stephanie. And I'm glad that you were able to remember those meetings. So when I started researching, again, I had in mind that, you know, here was a nurse, say, for example, who had a medication error. And because of that error, they would do what's called an investigation. And during that investigative time, this nurse may be on leave, she may be off while they're doing that. And my thought was, okay, what is she doing? What is she thinking? Is she thinking about her license? Is she thinking about her coworkers talking about her? Is she beating herself up? You know, is she getting in trouble? What's going on with her? And so what I started Googling and looking up and getting books is second victim is a real thing. It's a real phenomenon, and it's not very new. It was founded in 2000, so 20 years ago. And so the definition is a member of the healthcare community who's involved in an unanticipated or stressful event and is traumatized by the event. So, again, at that time, it was an error, right? A somebody did something and it affected a patient. And this was founded by Albert Wu at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He coined the term, and he's known as the father of the term second victim. Nowadays, when I think of second victim, I'm thinking about what we're going through now, right? Mm-hmm. This pandemic. Mm-hmm. And we're all second victims to all these things that are happening. You know, I watch the news, and if I hadn't watched it, I'd be okay. Mm-hmm. But now I'm watching the news about victims, and now I become victimized because I carry that residual, right? I'm walking around going, oh my goodness, you know, these people are dying. These people are dying at hospitals. And then here I am walking into a hospital. Mm-hmm. So it applies to so much more than just, you know, those errors that I started with in the beginning.
So in your workshops, you discuss how healthcare workers can suffer from the same victims, like you said, and the feelings as the first victim. So if I'm a healthcare worker and I'm listening to this podcast, what are some of the signs and symptoms of the effects of the second victim? And what are some of the stages that could help us identify, is this something that we are struggling with, or are these just the normal emotions that come with our day in and day out tasks and duties at our job? And how can listeners identify if this is something that they are struggling with?
That's a great question. And it's kind of twofold. So one is you want to know how to recognize for yourself when you're maybe in a rut, right? Like, this is just not my week, versus I feel I can't sleep. I don't want to go to work. I'm scared. I'm in the driving on the highway, and I'm already thinking about walking in that door and, you know, getting tested with my temperature and worried about that. So one thing is to just try as much as you can to be self-aware. Some of those things are, you know, waking up and thinking about what you're going to be doing that day, and if there's any questions that you have. Looking at the trauma and the emotional things that can happen to you, some things can be exhibited, like we talked about earlier, detachment, you know, or stress. We all have stress, but we know those employees, and especially you and I kind of had a little chat the other day about how lab workers are introverts, mm-hmm. just by nature, right? So they want to work by themselves. They maybe go a couple hours without talking to anybody. So how are you going to tell that they are experiencing emotional detachment, right? They're not talking as much. Well, they don't talk anyway, you know, but there may be other signs. There may be depersonalization. There may be confusion, some withdrawal. There may be a staff member that keeps talking about something over and over. You know, did you see that on the news? Or did you realize that the numbers went up from this to this? And people are like, well, I wasn't thinking about that, but now that you brought it up, and then everybody's just, you know, kind of talking about it. Or you may have the opposite. That's called like the presenteeism, where somebody is overly present, right? Well, I'll stay late, you know, Stephanie, I'll work 16 hours because I feel like that's what I need to do. And then you may have absenteeism, right? So you may have, you know, Johnny who comes in not just at 8, but like 15 till every day, brings donuts, gets his little workstation set and is ready to go. He may be calling in, right? He may be saying, I'm running late. And maybe he is, but you may start seeing a pattern, right? And so those are kind of some of the things you want to look for. You also want to look at, you know, kind of just the things that could be very drastic. You could have somebody with severe symptoms where they physically are sick, right? You could have people having nausea, vomiting, from worry. You can see visible anxiety. And then you could have people quit their job. And unfortunately, in severe cases, there have been people who have committed suicide. And that's a tragedy, because this is something that I think people know about, but maybe don't know how to handle. And so having a buddy, you know, to check in on, or having someone to check in on you, hey, you've been late a couple of days, everything going okay? Yeah, those are kind of the signs to look at. There's all kinds of things. I think managers, leaders need to know that who they're working with and leave themselves open mm-hmm. to somebody coming up to you, because with the introverts, you may not have people coming up to you, but you may have to go to them.
I think that is so poignant and so interesting. And I will say, as a laboratory leader, you have had to kind of notice what are those different signs, because people process pain and people process stress in totally different ways. And so from my own personal experience, as we've been going through this COVID-19 pandemic and this frontline healthcare worker fight, we found some employees breaking down emotionally and maybe crying in the workplace and just needing to talk through their, you know, maybe their stress and anxiety about not being able to find Clorox and only being able to buy one meat in the grocery store, or the fact that the grocery store has limited their hours. In the beginning, the grocery stores in Texas had limited their hours to, I think, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Several of our employees work 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And so there was a large struggle, especially for those that are single-parent households, to get the resources they needed for their family. I've also seen the other extreme where people would make jokes. And so, you know, some people have a force field of sarcasm that they would use. And for other people, those jokes may have seemed inappropriate during this time because maybe they had a family member that was going through COVID, et cetera. I'm really happy that you brought up, you know, the laboratory aspect of these things, because I think from the research that me and you have talked about, many of the articles are really focused and geared towards nursing. However, I can think of instances in the laboratory. Perhaps you work in the blood bank and you're working on a massive transfusion, and all of a sudden the blood orders stop and you just don't get that closure of what happened to that patient. You have to move on to the next patient. Or maybe you see perpetual orders for a cancer patient every week or a NICU baby every day, and then all of a sudden those orders just stop and you're not aware of what happened. Perhaps even on a happier note, you know, we have employees that work in our HLA department, our histocompatibility and immunogenetics department, that work actively hand-in-hand and collaborate with the transplant department to do the typing and do the compatibility for a donor in an organ. And, you know, they don't get the closure to know what happened. Was the surgery successful? Is that patient, you know, going to go through living, you know, a full life, or is their organ going to reject? And sometimes those thoughts can haunt you. And so what should a person who thinks that they may be suffering from second victim syndrome do to get emotional or psychological help? You touched on perhaps having a buddy. And now I feel like you are my buddy since we've talked so much. But what else can people do to get that emotional and psychological help that is going to be so important to help them get through this and recover?
Well, I'm glad you consider us buddies, because I do too. And I think that the difference between having, you know, a regular buddy that you go and have lunch with versus an accountability buddy or event buddy is that it's not somebody that you work with on the daily. It's not somebody that you meet with all the time who knows everything about you. It's somebody that you feel you trust, that you can look at and say, hey, Stephanie, I'm having a bad day, you know, and you can say, I hear you. I'm with you. What do you need? Oh, maybe let's just get a cup of coffee. Okay, that's great. We don't have to rehash everything, but you just check on each other. One of the things that we use, and because I do work in palliative care, what I've realized is that a lot of it kind of goes to, like, we're using some of those techniques to deal with staff. You mentioned the lab and how they don't get closure. And that's something that, until we talked, I had not thought about. And I started thinking, you know, I appreciate the frontline staff. I am a nurse. I'm not a frontline nurse, but I supervise several of them, and I know how hard they're working. At the same time, doctors and nurses cannot help patients without results. And so the lab is, like, to me, the unseen heroes, right? They're touching, they're holding COVID in their hands sometimes. And so kudos to you and to them, and for them not being really in the spotlight, but being able to hang in there. But that is hard when you don't have closure, because, you know, you may see, you know, 3 months ago, they may be doing some COVID testing in-house or what have you, getting results and say, like, oh, we've got 3 out of, you know, 20. And now it's like, oh, we've got 19 out of 20, or, you know, and how does that affect you, right? You're sitting here thinking, okay, who are these people? You know, am I going to go home and give this to my family? And so some of the things that we can do is, other than looking out for each other, is just making sure that we ask the questions that we want to. There are no stupid questions. If you have a question like, you know, is this going to end? It's okay to be honest and say, I don't know. I'm worried just like you are. One of the acronyms that we use for emotion and empathy is called NURSE. It's N-U-R-S-E. And that's something that either you and a friend, or maybe you and a coworker, maybe a subordinate or another leader, could go to somebody and say, N is name the emotion. You know, this is scary. Identifying that this is a scary time. Understand is the you. I can't imagine how stressful this is. Respect, I really admire your strength. I really admire you coming in here every day and, you know, support, offering your continued support. Is there something that you need? I notice you've been coming in later every day. Is there something that you need? And they may say, well, you know, my wife's working at home doing the homeschooling, and so, you know, that's why I'm getting here late. Well, let's look at the schedule. Maybe we can adjust that a little bit. And then exploring emotions. Tell me more. I have the time. You know, give them 5-10 minutes. Especially if there's somebody who doesn't want to talk, I think that goes a long way, because that kind of helps them. It validates that you're scared. It's okay. We're all scared. But we're all in this together, and we all need to support each other in order to get through this.
I think that's so poignant. And what you said about the COVID testing is so true. I mean, the average medical technologist working the bench may not have all of the aggregate data that we have from a high level that says the percentage of positive, but they certainly know that they're reporting out more positive results than they were yesterday. And they may be also experiencing family members that are positive. I know for myself, working in the laboratory, as we started to increase on volume, not only was I worried about, you know, myself in working in the hospital and bringing COVID home to my family, but I was also worried about, you know, my extended family. So my parents and, you know, my young niece that's starting college and her living in the dorm, and what would that mean for her and her health and her safety. And especially, you know, for me, if you're like me, your whole family is not necessarily medical and don't have the medical knowledge and the medical mind that we all have. And so for some of them, I was telling you about the story about my mom and me, you know, having some frustrating conversations with her, because she would say, well, I go to the store early in the morning, and I would tell her, Mom, COVID doesn't sleep. You know, it doesn't wake up in the morning. Just because you go early in the morning, you know, you are putting yourself at risk. So we need to follow the stay at home and shelter in place and, you know, reduce our movements as much as possible to keep ourselves safe until we can get to a point where we can do those things safely, or at least more safely. So I definitely understand where you're coming from. And especially like you talked about with the news, right now there are some very heavy headlines. And when you talk about the concerns of people not wanting to wear a mask versus, you know, all those others that are following the orders and wearing the mask in areas where you have those mandates, or the government reopening and what's going to happen with the schools, and, you know, how are we going to, you know, be able to educate our children, to all of the other heavy headlines with the different numerous movements that are very meaningful and very needed right now. They can, you know, collaboratively just be the perfect storm of emotional stress and weigh on a person. It really can. And so what advice would you give to listeners that are struggling to balance their job as a frontline worker, maintaining a home of life or a life of harmony and support, and also maintaining a sense of self during all of this?
That's a really, really good question, and I've thought about it a lot. I, too, have a mom who likes to venture out in the morning because those are senior hours, and I'm like, Mom, I know, but, you know, COVID still lives during senior hours, so I hear you on that. And then we always talk about work-life balance, right, and what that means. And I think right now that means a really different thing. I think it runs together.
And I think right now we're having a lot of role reversal. We're having, you know, people who normally work 9 to 5, now they're at home with the kids teaching homeschool. Mm-hmm. And we're at work thinking, you know, we've got it bad because we're nervous and we're having all these COVID patients come in, but we have precautions. We're washing our hands. We're doing what we're supposed to. But we've had a really bad day and we've seen the headlines and we get home and, you know, the first thing we want to do is like tell our husband, like, oh my gosh, you would not believe my day. And they're like, you know, you wouldn't believe my day with teaching kids, 3 kids homeschool. And you're like, no, mine's more important or mine's worse. And, you know, I was doing that for a while and my husband finally came to me and was very honest. And he was like, you know what? That's not fair. It's not fair to take what you're doing that is so important, but it's something that I would never, ever know. In other words, you have residual from things that are happening at your work that nobody knows, that the news doesn't know, that we don't see on TV, and you're telling me, not specifics, but just the idea, you know, and so then I have to carry that residual. So your chest is free. You feel great. You're like, I vented. But then he's walking around like, what the heck? You know, here I am. Now I'm worried about stuff I didn't even know was even happening. And it took him to, like, literally sit me down and tell me, I think you need to decompress before you come home. And it was hard because I'm like, what do you mean? I'm working all day, you know. But it made sense because before COVID, you know, I had an hour commute. And so without knowing it, I was decompressing. I would listen to a podcast or I'd listen to the radio or maybe a book on tape. And I had an hour to clear my head from work drama to get to my driveway and be like, okay, I'm ready for my mom job. But now it's different. You know, we've got people working from home. I get home in 20 minutes and I'm not ready to be home yet. I'm still thinking about the meeting we had or the numbers climbing or, you know, the lab, you know, the stress in the lab. And so he sometimes tells me, well, then just take the long way home, you know. and I said, you know, you're right, you know, because if I'm not ready to come in, then I have things, if I need to cry in my car or if I need to sit there and do a meditation, if I need to stop by the church and have a little one-on-one, whatever it is that I need to do, I need to for myself is kind of try as much as I can to separate. The other thing I kind of talk about and I think we've discussed before is that sometimes we have like a really weird sense of humor. And that's only because if you don't, it's really hard to deal with things like this every day. I always say that feelings are okay. It's okay to be sad. Sad is a feeling. Oh, but she's crying. It's okay. That's okay to cry. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to be mad. But dealing with those kinds of things, whatever it is, you know, if you're, you know, making a joke or you're watching something and everybody starts cracking up, it may not even be that funny, but everybody just needs that outlet. So a lot of times you may walk by and see our team laughing and you're like, what's wrong with them? Everybody's in a pandemic. Like, why are you laughing? But we do have to vent in whatever way we can. Mm-hmm.
I think that's so true, and obviously, in order to deal with having second victim feelings, your support system is going to be so important. So it's really important, it sounds like, not to shut out your support system. It's really important to have those honest communications. I love that your spouse even encouraged you, you know, take the long way home. Take some time to decompress. Because you're right, you know, when you come home, a whole nother job is expected to start, especially if you have little ones or children at home. And so all of those obligations are super important. So I want to ask you, from a personal standpoint, if you could go back and look at a young Kristen and all of your experiences that you've had at the bedside and all of your experience you've had working with abused families, unfortunately, and you understood, you know, I have second victim emotions or I'm experiencing second victim syndrome, what advice would you give in hindsight to a younger version of yourself now that you have all of this knowledge?
Now, I hadn't really thought about that, but as I see these new, especially now, you know, new doctors coming in, new nurses coming in, I when I was in nursing school, I had a medication error. I was a brand new student, and it wasn't tragic. Nonetheless, I gave a patient the wrong medication, or gave him a medication that halted a surgery that he was going to have that day. So I felt horrible, right? I'm a student. I should be checking 50 times, you know, because I have to go show my teacher what I'm doing. But I gave the medicine, and then later on they caught it before his surgery. So he was okay. It was delayed. The doctor was mad. My instructor was more like, oh, thank God, they're not going to, like, sue the school. But I felt horrible, and I felt like, you know, I really wish I could talk to that patient and tell him, like, I didn't come in today to do this. I didn't come in and purposely make this error. I maybe must have had something going on. And so since back then we didn't have the coined term second victim, and it wasn't practice, it wasn't something that they taught in school to recognize these things, right? I was a perfect student. That day something was off, right? I don't know what it was. But I guess I would tell my younger self that if somebody didn't come and ask me, that I should seek help and say, look, I made this error, and I know everything's hunky-dory and everything's great, but I'm feeling distressed about it. And because I'm so worried, I don't want to make another mistake. And so I think that that kind of planted the seed to where knowing the why is so important, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you may have, you know, done this or done that. I mean, I've come to work with two different shoes on some days. And I'm like, oh, not only is that embarrassing, but why? What is going on, right? Like, am I that tired, or is my family, like, just, are we so not in tune? But knowing the why, and as a young nurse, I would say, if, since this wasn't a thing, to seek it, to start it, to say, hey, teacher, you didn't ask me, but I'm telling you, something's going on, because I never would have done this. Mm-hmm. And I would like the opportunity to talk to that patient and tell them that I was sorry. Mm-hmm. Because that plays a big, big role in second victimization is, you know, if this happens to be, you know, second victimization can present as a leader, you know, losing it and yelling at the staff and saying, everybody get back to work. And everybody's like, what did we do? You know? And then taking that time to figure out the why, and maybe the next day coming in and saying, guys, hey, that wasn't my best leadership moment, but, you know, I too am frustrated. You know, I know everybody here is frustrated, and I've been, you know, thinking a lot. So if there's anything that you guys need, I just want you to know that, you know, as a leader, that was not my best moment. And just being honest and being human, I think is the best thing.
I think it's really important for healthcare workers to remember that although we have these really important jobs, just like the people who work in the grocery store right now, and just like our frontline, you know, EMS workers and firefighters and et cetera, but we have emotions too. And when we see things, they hurt us too, and they stick with us for a long time. I'm really glad you brought up that error, because as soon as you said that, it brought me back to an error I made as a young medical laboratory scientist in my rotations in training, and I was doing my training in a clinic that the left side of the clinic was an OBGYN L&D clinic, and the other side of the clinic was a pediatric clinic, and I had two urine specimens for both for pregnancy tests, and I swapped them, and the only way they knew definitively that there had been an error is because one of the patients was a labor and delivery expecting mom, and she most definitely knew that she was, you know, pregnant, and the other was a 15-year-old from the pediatric side of the house. And so I reported out that this 15-year-old was pregnant when she really wasn't, and it caused, as you may know if you've got a 15-year-old little girl out there, it caused quite the commotion, and I felt horrible. The parents got involved. The young lady did have a boyfriend, and so that was a huge debacle. And I mean, I really felt bad. I wanted the opportunity to apologize to those parents and apologize to those patients and let them know that, you know, I had not done my best work. You know, there were, and now that I'm thinking about it, there were other things going on. I was finishing up my rotation. I was trying to find a job as, you know, many of you may be, if you're finishing up your clinicals and you're applying for jobs. I was trying to find a new place to live and determine, should I get a new apartment or should I rent a house? It all depends on where I find my job. And so I had so many things going on in my mind. And so, you know, like I said, to error is human, and we all make errors. And we just have to remember that there are things that happen. There are things that happen, and the emotions behind those are completely normal, and it's okay. And you get past it, and you get through it, and you move on. What are some tidbits or resources that you can leave our listeners with that they can use in their professional life? I know there are a lot of great articles, perhaps even some apps that they can download or books that they can read.
Absolutely. So we could go on and on talking about this. Luckily, there's a lot of information, especially right now. We have ABC News talking about labs and the workers and how they are coming and saying things like, you know, what about the labs? They work there too. But some of the things that we need to look at is joining organizations or just reading up about it. A lot of it is geared to nurses, I'm not going to lie, but it's applicable to anybody. So American Nursing Association has a whole initiative on how to get through the COVID crisis. There's an app called Mood Fit. There's an app called Happy App. And then we also have the Center for Study of Traumatic Stress. Joint Commission has a lot of information. And STRAC here in San Antonio has a lot of information about self-care and kind of specific things on what to do and not to do. And one of the main things that they say is to avoid black and white thinking. So right now, we live in a world of gray, right? Because there's no yes or no answer. You know, if I say, when is this going to end? You cannot tell me it's going to end on this certain date. If I say, you know, am I still going to have a job here or is my job going to change? You cannot say for a certain, absolutely yes. And so I think it's important for people to have emotionally kind of accepted that part. But there are different ways to just make sure that you plan for this. I know ethics, there's a lot of ethics councils right now talking about the allocation of resources. It's a scary thing, but it's something that you have to plan for. So if that's something that you're afraid of, maybe that's a council you should join, right? So that you can hear what everybody's doing to allocate ventilators. Who gets them? How do we decide that? That's a whole other topic of itself that just gives me anxiety thinking about. But I think all in all, I want to give a shout out to somebody that I saw on YouTube. Her name is Anastasia Stacy Pentwright, and she gave a TED Talk that I just happened to see when I was thinking about this. And the topic is called Drama in the Workplace, which, of course, it took my attention because although we're not talking about the, you know, catty drama, you know, too many women or something like that, she was talking about the amount of self-awareness that you have and how you can't control everybody. So if something happens, then you need to look at, well, what did I do and what can I do? Or somebody lets you down, or if you go through something and somebody says something that you don't agree with, then it's like, okay, they said that and now I know. Now I know that about them. And so maybe we'll put them on this other committee that does this. So I think it's helped raise awareness, especially in the time right now where people can get gossipy, people can get judgy. I think it's helpful to seek out things like that, TED Talks, you know, Google self-care, Google second victim, Google third victim, because now the third victim is the person I told. So I experienced something, and I'm the second victim, and now I'm telling you, now you're the third victim. So, yeah, it's something that right now, fortunately, we have a lot of information on.
Mm-hmm. And because you have so much knowledge, you've just been a wealth of knowledge here on today's show. And I appreciate you and honor all your expertise and your gift in this area. How can our listeners reach out to you?
You can reach out to me by email at Christine Salamante. It's KristineTine Salamante, T as in Tom, Alamante@att.net.
Well, there you have it. Thank you to our listening audience for tuning into the show with our special guest, Kristen, sharing with us the information about the second victim, the third victim, and really caring for yourself and understanding where you are and making sure that you are caring for yourself during this important time. I hope that you all have found this podcast helpful and useful, and that after this you'll use some of the resources that are mentioned today, or you'll reach out and try to understand a little bit more of how you can be mindful during this time and care for yourself. If you like what you heard and you want to listen to previous shows, you can subscribe to our show at directimpactbroadcasting.com. Always remember to email myself and my co-host at our email address. It's elaboratetopics@directimpactbroadcasting.com to learn more about this topic or even to be a guest on our show. You can follow me at Stephanie Whitehead on my social medias, Facebook and LinkedIn, or Stephanie Y. Whitehead on Instagram. Please tune in next week for another amazing episode of Elaborate Topics, and until then, have a great evening.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Elaborate Topics, where your hosts discussed relevant strategies for laboratory professionals. Please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform and listen to us on directimpactbroadcasting.com. Stay tuned for another episode with information you can use to excel in your laboratory career.